Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning for another foray into the madness of the true crime genre. In today's episode, we're headed overseas to Japan to examine the infamous murder of the Misayawa family, whose bodies were discovered inside their Tokyo home on the morning of December 31st, 2000. The Misayawas were located in the city's most densely populated of 23 wards, a place known as Setagaya. The four-member immediate family consisted of husband and father, Mikio, wife and mother, Yasuko, 8-year-old Nina, and her 6-year-old brother, Rei. Mikio and Yasuko met in a personal development class in the 1980s and married shortly thereafter. They moved into their home in Setagaya around 1990 when there were still approximately 200 homes crammed into the neighborhood. Over the course of that decade, however, the Japanese government, along with third-party wholesale home buyers, began cutting deals with residents to buy back their homes and demolish them, making way for numerous construction projects. What was then a residential area started to become increasingly repurposed toward public space. The homes surrounding the Misayawas disappeared, slowly but surely, and by the year 2000, only 4 remained. The city and developers with whom they were working continuously applied pressure by offering deals to relocate these residents, but as is normally the case, the last of them don't want to go. This isn't an unfamiliar situation. In fact, it's been a regular occurrence all over the world since property ownership flourished in major cities that continue to grow and change. And when people refuse to move, sometimes the situation gets ugly. The strategy, if you're one of these third-party companies, is to go in lowballing people with a cash offer and the notion that the wrecking ball is coming, no matter what resistance is provided. Over time, most people go. But as they do, those remaining are provided an increasing sense of leverage that equates to the rule of quote-unquote last man standing on the battlefield. The longer you can hold out against these advances, the more desperate your opponent can become. And since they've already collected all of those lowball homes at a better rate, they can offer you a little more down the stretch to get you to finally say yes. But some people don't. Whether it has to do with their health, simply loving a location, fear of moving, etc. And if the parties involved can get 196 out of 200 homes demolished, it means those last 4 are going to be occupied by people who are nothing less than a total pain in the ass. More specifically, look what has happened. Mikio Misayawa moved his family into the most densely populated ward in Tokyo, which is also somewhat upscale in terms of price. And since these 196 homes are gone now, in the year 2000, he has all of this evacuated land nearly to himself. He shares it with only 3 other homes, rather than 196 other homes, making his plot almost surreal in the sense that it appears to be rural, but it's right in the middle of Tokyo. It's ideal. There are empty plots all around the home, and it's located directly next to the Sen River, which essentially means, without question, the Misayawas had more land and privacy than any other person living in that part of the city. And if you received that over time, your expectations would also start to change with your new reality. For instance, if you live in the most crowded ward in Tokyo, a city notorious for being crowded everywhere, what you can expect is that you're going to encounter a lot of noise from your neighbors. It's unavoidable. So much so that when Mikio and Yasuko had Yasuko's parents move in next door, in a semi-detached house with a shared wall, they installed ample soundproofing. That soundproofing, without question, makes a statement that says Mikio understood the implications of living in this part of the city. It's noisy, especially in relation to your neighbors. Even with the people next door being his wife's parents, he still knows it's necessary to dull the noise. Now, over the course of time, with a river on one side of the house and empty lots surrounding them, the reduced noise is going to change Mikio's perception of how things should be. The family gets used to the lack of noise, whereas everyone else in this ward is experiencing something really noisy. It's peaceful here now. It didn't used to be. And so they don't really have a reason to move out anymore. Not only are they happy here, but the land is becoming increasingly private, something unheard of in that location. Sounds too good to be true, right? Because it is. If the city was buying out your neighbors to create more public space, well, guess who's going to show up soon? The public. Accordingly, a park is built directly behind the Misayawas, bringing a walking and running path nearly right up to the backside of their house. Across the street from that park, the city builds a skate park for local skateboarders. These things were not built with consideration for the family staying. To the contrary, as the family held up the process, the city moved forward in completing what it could. Ironically for Mikio, his private residential paradise becomes a public space. It's an inevitability. As it's no longer a residential area, there are people in the park at all hours, making lots of noise. Worse, the skate park is even much noisier, and the teens are apathetic about it. What's happening is that Mikio's refusal to leave is causing outsiders to encroach upon his property, from skaters to runners to drug addicts and dealers, and more. There used to be a neighborhood watch, like a security patrol, but it was disbanded with so many houses being torn down. The family doesn't feel as safe as they once did, and begin to notice strangers lurking in the area at odd times. Well, no shit. It's a public space now. No wonder they're around your home. What's preventing the family from leaving is that they are not only comfortable in their current home, which allows them to live side by side with Yusuko's parents, yet still separate, but they're having trouble finding a suitable new place. In late 2000, fed up with the situation after indulging arguments with skateboarders and a local motorcycle gang over noise issues, Mikio reaches a deal with the local city government to move to a new residence. That move is planned for March 2001, about 3 months away. They're having a new home built in a situation that allows them to move Yusuko's parents in too. Now, Mikio is described as a nice, polite man. But let's get real. If he confronted the skateboarders and also the motorcycle gang in a situation in which he was the one in the wrong because he wouldn't move the hell off of what has become public land and is obsolete for residential purposes, then we could expect his behavior to be similar when faced with aggressive attempts by other parties to acquire his home. Now, if he made a deal with the city to leave and even has a date to move out, they have no reason to turn around and kill him in some sort of shady deal geared toward greater profit. The city's going to offer a price. You take it or you leave it. That's it. And clearly, in the end, Mikio felt that he had to take it. And he did. So there really wasn't any conflict there as far as that goes with the city. On the other hand, if you were a third-party wholesale home buyer who made a business of offering cash for homes with the intention of turning around and selling them back to the city at a greater profit by forcing their hand with leverage, you'd have ample reason to kill him. If you're that company and are able to acquire all four houses the city needs to demolish to proceed with development, you hold the type of leverage that could be very valuable. You bring the hammer down on the price because the city can afford it. Think of it like a collection agency. They use increased aggression to collect what they can from the customer and then take a large portion of it as compensation. Essentially, that's what a third-party home buyer would try to do here, act as a middleman, so to speak, or a liaison between Mikio and the city and profit off it by getting a lot more money out of it. Now, you might say, but if he already made a deal with the city to leave, then there was a deal to leave. Killing him wouldn't negate that deal. No, it wouldn't. And that's the point of killing this family. You can't make a deal with them anymore. So, they're expendable. You have to focus on the three remaining homes. And if you did that, what would be the easiest way to intimidate them to leave? Killing the Misayawas, because they were the only expendable family left there. If the city buys their home, which was going to happen, and even Mom's house next door thereafter, guess what? You still have two homes left that are preventing development from moving forward. If you can scare those people into getting out, which is very likely happening after four brutal murders, even if they were reluctant before, you can pressure them into taking deals they otherwise would not have indulged, and also tax the city pretty hard on what you charge them, because you now have greater leverage. Two of the three houses in question are as follows. The semi-detached house next door, where Yusuko's parents live, and the one directly across the street, which has a front door maybe 30 feet from where the family was butchered. Would you live right there afterward, alone, if your house was the only one still standing? Probably not. I mean, hell no, right? So that's the idea. I believe they killed the expendable party, meaning the one that was no longer able to make them any money, and intimidated the remaining residents by default of the crime. If you do such a thing, the likely result is that the other residents want out and are willing to get lowballed in a case where they weren't previously. And the city, having its hand forced by a third-party buyer, will realize it's being held hostage by the third-party buyer for a much higher price, because those few homes are all that stands between the city being able to develop the land in the way they desire. I don't know how quickly the other residents left, but Yasuko's parents moved out immediately, even going so far as to leave the city. They were truly terrified. I have to imagine that the people across the street felt the same way, and obviously, if there's only one remaining home after that, do you really want to be the person who lives in that house? Because if there's no one else to kill except you, kind of going to leave you anxious at night. So again, just picture yourself as the neighbor whose front door was directly across a narrow street from these unexplained killings. If you were one of the last families or residents remaining there, and this happened, a thought would have crossed your mind at some point that went like this. I wonder if it's because they refused to leave. And you wouldn't know, but wondering might be enough to make you believe it could happen to you too. And that's the point. Living in a public space is actually less secure. The killer was only able to get away with this crime because of the isolation of the home and its proximity to so many public spaces. If it had happened anywhere else in Setagaya, the task would have been virtually impossible. And that's what makes it so scary for the remaining residents. This could easily happen again. There's nothing stopping it from happening again. There's no neighborhood watch. It looks like it's a rural area. There's shady public people all around. Anyhow, as far as skateboarders go, just ask yourself which of these options is more logical. You, a skateboarder, get in an argument with a guy who lives next to the skate park about being loud near his home one day, and then that's that. It's over after the argument. Or you're so offended that you decide at a later point the correct punishment is to go back to this man's home and murder everyone in extremely brutal fashion. Let's get real. All this complaint by Mikio amounts to, in terms of the skateboarders, is the equivalent of an old man telling kids to get off his lawn. That doesn't lead to murder. Skateboarders are used to being harassed by families and cops and everyone else for intruding upon their space. Thus the reason, Ironically, that the city built the skate park here and tried to get rid of the homes. They're trying to give the skaters a place. The skaters weren't the ones being displaced. The city was on their side, obviously. Mikio was fighting a losing battle. Same goes for the motorcycle gang, which I assume was in the park. Most clubs described as motorcycle gangs are, in fact, not gangs at all, but just clubs of people who ride together and sometimes look similar to the other people who indulge a criminal lifestyle as well. Plus, I don't really know the circumstances, but it doesn't seem as though either of these incidents, in terms of the skateboarders or the motorcycle club, was ongoing or violent. I just don't see enough in the way of resources at stake to believe that this family was killed over an argument with one of those parties. It qualifies as nothing more than salvaging pride. Really are no resources at stake. What's more likely is an altercation at the point of contact when tempers are flaring. And that doesn't seem to have happened. Nobody threw a punch at him. He didn't throw a punch at everyone. There were no fights. Combining that with the notion that Mikio was a friendly man, I'm guessing he was disagreeable and frustrated in these situations, but not hostile. He was a fairly small and middle-aged man. Taking on a motorcycle gang or a group of skaters probably wouldn't be too advisable. Now, the reason I've decided to preface the episode with the type of person I believe would commit this crime, a hitman or hired assassin, is that I think it benefits our understanding of the events as they unfold. There are those who think this attack targeted a specific member of the family, but by the end, Occam's razor shows us one thing which cannot be ignored. The family is out of the house. They have vacated the premises permanently. Whomever commissioned this crime, or if it was committed by the person himself, failed to accomplish that goal in the past, and, in my opinion, doubled down by punishing them with an ironic fate that would, of course, get them out of the house forever. Of course, given the situation with the remaining homes, money could be at stake. Now, notice that when this is over, the family is out of the house and they get nothing in terms of finance. Just look at the mirrored image of that emotional wound, right? Picture yourself as the person who commissioned this. So if they're out of the house and they get nothing, the mirror of that would be the person who committed this being left out of the house and not receiving any money. So it's very clear from the psychological implications that the person who committed this crime was related to the home sale. Now, again, there was probably a lot of money at stake. Enough to get revenge on the family who rebuked you and who took the city's deal instead, leaving you nothing, so that the remaining families might be strongly motivated to get the hell out of their homes, given that there's an unsolved murder in the neighborhood. That doesn't dictate such a thing came to fruition, meaning sale of the remaining homes to third-party buyers who proceeded to hold the city for a large ransom, but I believe this crime would most likely have been committed for that reason. Now let's talk about the Misiawa's house. The layout is somewhat complicated, but as I always say, you just have to look for the intersection of the seeker and the sought to find the magic, to find the point of origin. Well, here, it's the horrifying gore, but also the truth. Now, again, it's a semi-detached house, meaning it shares a bordering wall with Yasuko's parents' house next door, but there isn't a passageway of any kind between them. If you want to visit, you have to go outside to the neighbor's house. So, on the morning of December 31st, Haruko, Yasuko's mother, tries to call her daughter at home next door, but the line isn't working. She goes over there. It's between 10 and 10:30 a.m., Haruko has a key to the home and uses it when nobody answers the door. Now, there's a huge point of contention here that can't be solved past speculation. Inside this front door is Mikio's study, in which, on the right, against the wall, there is desk space for two people. The space on the right of that desk, closest to the front door, has a desktop computer located on it. Police derived from the activity on the family's computer that somebody last used it at about 10:18 a.m., but that was after hours of inactivity in which they know the killer had to be the one using it. At first, they believed the killer was still there when Haruko arrived and fled quickly as she knocked, bumping the computer's mouse onto the floor. But later changed their minds to assert that Haruko probably bumped the mouse off the desk when she passed and has no remembrance of the incident due to seeing Mikio murdered. Now, here's what she sees. She walks in using the key on a locked door, and at the far end of Mikio's study, at the foot of the stairs leading to the next floor, she notices his butchered body full of stab wounds. About 10. The attack was so savage that the knife blade broke inside his body. He died here, but it's not where the violence began. Now, where his body lies, at the back of the study, again, is at the foot of the stairs, which you would ascend by turning left from that location. It's not a staircase to the second level in a traditional sense, because it goes up to a mezzanine level next, rather than what is officially the second floor. At the top of this staircase, Haruko finds the bodies of her 41-year-old daughter Yasuko and 8-year-old granddaughter Nina. And the carnage is much worse than what Haruko saw downstairs. Yasuko lying on the ground at the top of the stairs to the right, and Nina, positioned next to her on the left, are stabbed and slashed nearly beyond recognition, to the point one could believe they were truly the intended targets. Now, if you look back downstairs from that spot, given the blood evidence found, it becomes obvious that Mikio was attacked in the same spot as the other two, yet he was knocked or even fell backward during the struggle and went down the stairs. So the attack on Mikio was vicious, but he hadn't been slashed about the face like the other two. Of course, that leaves 6-year-old Rei to be discovered, but by this point, Haruko realizes she needs to get out of the house quickly and call the police. Did she bump the mouse running out of the house, thinking nothing of it because she just saw her daughter, granddaughter, and son-in-law butchered? Probably. The killer would have prior knowledge of who these people were, and I would bet anything that the whole point of not killing the parents too is so it would be guaranteed the family was found the next day. Not only that, but more importantly, found quickly. Whatever the person who commissioned or even committed this crime had planned, it seems to have been contingent upon getting this family out of the house, or at least committing the murders and having them confirmed as dead before the new year arrived the next day. In fact, when Haruko was asked initially if she noticed anything missing from the home, meaning in plain sight, she told them the family had a collection of New Year's cards received from loved ones and friends on display, and they were all gone after the murder. Like, haha, you won't be needing these. It also could have been that the shady company in question, in terms of the home sale, offered the family a deal that required them to move out by the end of the year, and Mikio balked. So in line with that same dark humor, the person sent someone to move them out by that date. But what we can see from this centralized location of the murders at the top of the first staircase is that it doesn't tell a complete or even apparent story. You have to indulge the rest of the crime scene first to understand how things got here. I mean, from the looks of it, you'd think Mikio, Yasuko, and Nina all got attacked in one place at the same time, which provokes wonder about how nobody escaped. So let's go beyond this point into the rest of the house. Now again, Haruko walked in the front door. That's the study. She goes to the back of the room and finds Mikio dead at the base of a staircase that turns left to go up to the mezzanine level. It's not a full staircase, it's just a few steps shy, because the mezzanine level is lower than the second floor. More on that in a moment. Now, if you go upstairs from the study on that staircase at the top, on the floor, are Yasuko's body on the right and Nina's body on the left. That landing constitutes part of the hallway on the mezzanine level. If you're standing at the top of the stairs there, you have the back of the house off to your right, which is where the toilet, shower, and sink are located in different rooms along the wall with small windows. While Haruko obviously couldn't see it from her vantage point, in the far back left corner of the home, in the room where the shower is located, a small window is open. Beneath it is a fence surrounded by small trees with a few broken branches. A person can reach this window while standing on top of one of the fence posts because it's not a second floor window. It's the mezzanine level, placing it just a few feet lower, within reach of someone agile enough to pull himself up there. Our perpetrator will prove to be, to the best of our knowledge, a man no older than his 30s who stands about 5 feet 7 inches and possesses a 32-inch waist. We'll talk more about that. It was easy to derive his stature as he left all of his bloody clothes behind. Footprints and freshly broken branches around the trees led authorities to realize the intruder had obviously escaped in this manner, but what was troubling is that they didn't find prints to suggest he entered this way. I'd suggest that he did actually enter and exit this way, and that we have to remember one detail that differentiates the two activities. On the way into the house, the intruder is the agile, physically fit young man we assume him to be, based upon the task he completed. But when the killer left, at the very least, he did so with a deep wound on one hand. Now, picture him trying to lower himself to the fence below using that thing. I mean, that's going to be absolutely brutal. He's not going to be able to do it very well with one hand, or at least not with any measure of stealth. I just think the guy leaving, in terms of physical condition, is tired, badly injured, and less capable than the one who entered. He got sloppy. Alternatively, if he didn't enter through the back window in the shower room and only exited that way, it would have been more than possible to enter through the front of the home. But we have to pose the same question here as we do for the back of the house. Did the killer just get lucky trying that window and find it open? Or did he have to try more than that? We don't really know, though the investigation seems to lead us to believe he tried the small back window and it worked. I would have to agree he went there first because, again, it's part of the mezzanine level and lower than a second floor, leaving it accessible from the top of the fence. Mikio was on the computer in the study downstairs, and that room is the only one on the first floor with windows. The next closest window is on the mezzanine, which can be accessed from the back of the home, away from Mikio. The back of the home also faces the park, and nobody would be there, in the cold, that late at night, we assume. Now, again, Mikio is downstairs, but he's facing the computer, or facing right. Behind him is a door and small window leading to the driveway outside it. In the driveway sits the family's vehicle, which rests almost touching the garage door, as parking any farther away from it would put the front end of the car in the street. Something evidenced by the soot stain built up there on the garage door in the center over the years. They always park here, obviously, something that was acknowledged by Haruko, but also made obvious by the soot stain, again, in the center of the garage door, where the exhaust is. If the car is parked there, and Mikio has his back turned toward the PC, reading his work email, the killer could very easily stand on top of the car, grab the bars on the balcony above, on the mezzanine level, and pull himself up, which would be equivalent to the action out back of standing on the fence and pulling himself up to the window, because again, that's also on the mezzanine level. Now, let's go back to the top of the stairs where we left off with the bodies of Yasuko and Nina. That's the mezzanine level. So, if we turned right at the top of the stairs, the hallway would lead to any of the shower, toilet, or sink. In front of those rooms, however, is a pull-down ladder that extends from the ceiling to allow access to the attic, or third floor. More on that in a minute. But if we're standing at the top of the stairs by those bodies again, turning left instead takes us into the kids' room, at the culmination of which is the door leading to the balcony. Yet, if we stop short of the kids' room in the hallway, to our left, we find a very short set of stairs leading to what is considered the second floor. So think of the second floor as the second floor on the right side of the house, and the mezzanine level on the left side of the house. So they're just separated by a couple of feet. It's almost like they're the same floor. The only difference is that there is a staircase with maybe three or four stairs at most separating those two sides of the house. So on the right side of the house, on the second floor, there's a kitchen and living room. On the mezzanine side of that level, on the left, down the few stairs to where we were just standing as we walked away from the bodies, is the kids' room. To summarize, if you walked into the house and went to the back of the study, you'd find Mikio's body on the floor at the base of a staircase that goes left upstairs. At the top of that staircase, which is nearly a full staircase but just a bit shy, on the floor in the hallway are the bodies of Yasuko and Nina. If you go right from there, on the mezzanine level, it takes you to the back of the house with toilet, shower, sink. There's also a pull-down ladder to the attic. However, if you go left at the top of the stairs where the bodies are found on the landing, you'll pass a very short set of stairs on your left going up a few feet to the kitchen and living room. If you walk past those short stairs, continuing along that same hallway, again, you enter the kids' room with a view of the balcony straight ahead at the far end. In front of the balcony entrance, along a wall, there are study desks for each child. Along the near, recessed wall on the right, inside the kids' room as you enter, are bunk beds, and 6-year-old Ray was strangled to death in one of the bunks. He was not stabbed. Now, we know where the bodies are at this point, but we don't get a clear picture of what transpired until we go up to the attic, or third floor, which is also essentially the master bedroom. The attic is accessed by the pull-down ladder on the mezzanine level, in the ceiling, and has a low-sloped roof. If you were trapped in this room, unable to come down the ladder, going out the window would put you 3 floors above the ground. It's not a good place to be. Plus, I doubt fire code allows a lock inside an attic door located on the ceiling. That's not to say they didn't have one, but I doubt it. A person could get trapped. Now, when investigators went up to the master bedroom in the attic, they discovered blood everywhere. Not as though an attack took place. Rather, somebody was bleeding and someone else was trying to stop it. The blood found all over the room, and on bandages and a first aid kit present, belonged to 8-year-old Nina. But it was clear from the imprint upon that blood that her mother Yasuko was with her. However, Yasuko was not bleeding at the time. So what we can deduce from this is that the killer had a very strong strategy given his limited resources. There's nothing present within the evidence at the scene to suggest he utilized a firearm in any way, even just as a measure of control. That means killing 4 people throughout such a complex residence is going to have its challenges. And when you reverse engineer anything, what you need to do is go back to the point of origin, which equates to the crosshairs on a gun, aka the intersection of the seeker and the sought. The killer needs to find an intersection at which he will undoubtedly cross paths with the victims in a manner that they literally don't know where he is or if he's even real until the point at which they meet their maker. If he behaves like that, like God, to the best of his ability, he escapes, unknown. He must find an intersection at which he has greater knowledge and they possess greater ignorance. If he helms that centralized point, he'll smoke these people. Unfortunately, because this is especially brutal and involves young children. Now, what's clear to me is that what the killer initially intended quickly devolved into a more desperate situation. Whether he entered by way of the shower window in the back of the house facing the park, or through the balcony by climbing up onto the family's car in the driveway, the killer finds himself on the mezzanine floor, where the kids sleep in bunk beds. I think his intention is to go in as quietly as possible and attempt to strangle both children in their bunk beds, again, in silence. I am assuming the younger Ray slept on the bottom bunk and was attended first. During the struggle, his sister likely awakened. Now, we don't know if she screamed or called out for her parents, or even just remained silent, but what's clear is that she fled the killer. My guess, given that Ray was dead at this point, and was never stabbed, is that once he finished with Ray, and moved upward to the top bunk to kill her, his approach awakened her. He might have even put his hands on her, and she freaked out and woke up right at that moment. So again, she likely freaked out, and as the killer was unable to control her, and she tried to flee, he slashed and stabbed at her for lack of another option. Of course, she knows her mom is right down the hallway and up the ladder to the third floor attic, or master bedroom. But this takes her running right past the staircase down to the first floor, beneath which her father could not only protect her from the killer's path, at least temporarily, yet also send her running next door to call police. So one would have to wonder why she didn't try to go downstairs and out the door, given that Dad was down there. Well, what we have to remember is that she's 8 years old, and when she wakes up in a stupor at what we believe is likely 11:30 p.m., she has no idea her father is still downstairs. She's going to think that Mom and Dad are both in bed, because to her perception, it's just the middle of the night. In truth, it seems like the killer expected Mikio to be in bed by this time as well, and literally got left out in the cold waiting until he no longer had a choice but to move in. Ideally, he'd want to enter the home when everyone was asleep, putting the kids on the second floor and parents on the third. If he managed to strangle the kids in silence, he could sneak up on the parents above. But since that plan failed, he adopted a new one that was equally effective, if not more, though it put him at greater risk. Still, he gave this some thought, had a plan, and adapted when adversity arrived. That's not the work of a sociopath. This is an emotionally unattached contract killer, perhaps even somebody with military training. What people in law enforcement and the military know all too well is that enclosed stairways are the stuff of nightmares. In a one-on-one situation, if you're the one who knows what's coming, you have a huge amount of leverage over an opponent or enemy. But if you're on the other side of that, death is upon you. So when the shit hits the fan here, and the attempt to slash and stab at Nina as she runs out of the room fails, the killer's reassessment bears an obvious conclusion. If this girl is running and screaming bloody murder out of her bedroom, guess what her father is going to do instinctually? He's going to try to save her by running up the stairs to see what's wrong and correct the issue. Yet, his instinct is likely going to cause him to do that in haste. And we see the result of that as he blindly goes up this stairwell, only to get surprised by a knife-wielding attacker at the top who jumps from out of nowhere and butchers him to death, knocking him down the stairs. He knows Dad is going to do this from an instinctual level, and Mikio never had a chance. Now, since Mom didn't get stabbed, we know Nina ran upstairs bleeding, and Mom got the first aid kit. Now, if you were these two unarmed people, what you'd want to do first, even if it was futile, is pull up the ladder and close the door. I mean, why give the killer free access to you? If it's possible, he doesn't know how to get up there. At this point, you don't even know if he knows what the attic is. But doing that would leave you unable to hear or see what's going on below. And that's especially a problem if one of you is bleeding profusely. If you're healthy, you can stay up there all night. But if you're losing a lot of blood from getting slashed and stabbed by a brand new sashimi knife and are 8 years old in that little body, things are a bit more desperate. You have a choice to make if you don't hear any noise for a long time while stuck up there. The other consideration is that if Nina woke up during an attack and fled, she might not know about Ray's fate. Yasuko would be desperate to know not only if he was alive, but what happened to her husband as well. I mean, can you imagine the anxiety of having to be up there with this child injured and not knowing what happened to everybody else? It's apparent there isn't a cell phone up there, and the killer unplugged the landline. So one might ask why Yasuko, with her mother next door, wouldn't start banging on the walls and screaming for help. Even with soundproofing, that much would be heard. The answer is that she and Nina were hiding in the attic with the ladder pulled up and didn't want to compromise their position because they didn't know if the killer knew where they were. We have to remember that the killer doesn't follow Nina. He waits for Mikio. The two of them might have been under the impression that the killer didn't know where they fled. And what happens next, though it happens in our ignorance, isn't difficult to figure out. With Ray and Mikio dead, all the killer needs to do is go back to that intersection at the top of the stairs to the mezzanine floor and reposition himself for the same attack against Nina and Yasuko's ignorance that he did for Mikio's. So put yourself in the killer's shoes at this point. Mother and daughter are in the ignorance of the attic, hiding. They can't see you and can't hear you with any decent measure of clarity. Ray's fate is probably not known because Nina fled from sleep to her mother upstairs, who was also asleep. They also don't know what happened to Mikio. They could assume, but in the same way Mikio's desperate desire to know the same things about the others led him to a tragic fate, the killer will ensure the same here. He just needs to wait in a different position around the stairwell, and they'll come down. Mother and daughter will want to know three things. One, is the killer still in the house, aka, is it safe to come down? Two, what happened to Ray? Three, what happened to Mikio? Yet, what's worse is that there will be extreme urgency on the mother's part to provide help beyond small bandages for stabs and slashes on her child's body. Picture yourself as this mother, wanting to hold tight upstairs in the attic and not compromise the only shelter you have, but also having the greatest instinct to get your daughter out of there to a place of safety and help. This situation is a terrible dilemma, a classic one which doesn't have a right answer. Now, let's go back to the killer's perspective again. He's just had a fight with Mikio in which the thin but razor-sharp sashimi knife blade broke off inside the victim's body. It has no tip. So once he finishes off Mikio, two things are apparent. He's broken his knife, but much worse, and which we understand from the blood and bandage evidence at the scene, he's cut himself pretty badly in the process. What he expected to be a quick, silent assassination in the middle of the night is now one where he's injured, stuck at the house, and unable to finish the job efficiently because the ladies are hiding while he's bleeding all over the place. We assume that the sneak attack on Mikio coming up the stairs led to the killer striking a part of the upper body that's heavily armored by bone, and the blade broke. That would also be the most likely moment in which his hand would slide down the blade as the bone offered enough resistance to make the metal snap. So the killer goes to the second floor kitchen and gets another knife. Now, if mother and daughter are hiding and can't see you, but can hear you faintly from up there, at the very least, the best thing you could do in terms of deception as the killer is to simply go back downstairs and open and close the front door with just enough force that they can hear it. And then you sneak back up the stairs and wait by the top, standing still in the stairwell in silence. If they try to come down from the attic and go to Ray's room to learn his fate, they have to pass you. If they try to go downstairs to see what happened to Mikio or to leave, you come face to face. But since the killer knows the child is bleeding, he also knows Mom needs hope. And if he opens and closes that front door, even just once, without her being able to see if it's true, it might just be enough to get her to risk coming out. The suspense and terror had to be dreadful beyond words. You keep a first aid kit at home for minor everyday injuries like a child falling off a bike and scraping a knee. Here is this desperate woman trying to comfort her terrified bleeding daughter with a first aid kit after an attempted murder. We know the killer was in the house for hours after the murders. I believe he either opened and closed the front door to feign leaving, or simply waited so long in silence Yasuko convinced herself he had left since he hadn't followed them into the attic. On the other hand, it's possible that Nina was so badly injured that there was simply no other choice but to go on faith and believe the killer was gone after all that time. Unfortunately, he wasn't. Again, he knows that intersection of the hallway and stairs on the mezzanine level is the place to be when they come down, specifically at the top of the stairs and shielded by the stairwell walls. In order to look down those stairs toward freedom, the pair would have to tempt fate. They did, and he was right there. He brutally, not to mention excessively, tortures and slaughters them with the knife he got from the kitchen, which is actually larger than the sashimi knife. Nina, the 8-year-old, gets it the worst, leading some to believe she was the intended target of a sexual predator. But what we can see here from the blood evidence is that she was not only the one who ruined his plan and caused all the chaos that led to his injury, but then he also had to wait around sulking in that miserable failure, bleeding on everything. He would want revenge. He's pissed. You see that he hasn't done the same thing to Mikio. The killer would leave a handkerchief at the scene with a slit in the middle, a common practice for those in the fish industry seeking a makeshift sheath for their knives that can be very effective yet still discarded at a moment's notice. So, it's clear this guy had every intention of not getting cut, but we know he didn't wear gloves during the crime because the ones he left behind weren't slashed or bloody. He seemed to have taken them off after wearing them for warmth outside in the cold winter night. Anyhow, when Nina and Yasuko make their move, it's obvious what they're thinking. They're wondering if the killer is downstairs. That's where he went last. So they come down the ladder from the attic, and they creep around the corner of the stairs to look, worried about him still being downstairs. And that's why this plan is perfect, because they're going to look down the stairs, but when they do, he's going to be directly in their face at the top of the stairs behind the wall. From a tactical standpoint, this person could have military training. He keeps his cool during what is a very chaotic, injurious moment for him, in which a lot of people would have said, oh, fuck this, I'm out of here. I'm especially impressed, relatively so, of course, by the fact that a frenzied attack didn't follow the little girl escaping his grasp. He kept his cool, dealt with the injury, bided his time, implemented Plan B, and won. When Nina and Yasuko took higher ground out of his sight, he flipped the script. He could have followed them into that ignorance, but he knew about Nina's injuries and knew about Mom's desires. Quite simply, he chose psychological warfare over simply attacking. He put himself in the one place where necessity would ultimately force them to go. And when they arrived, at their most desperate and least resourceful, they'd see it was a trap. If ever a home-invading killer utilized military strategy, this is it. It's impressive that he used it against Mikio, but truly haunting that he was able to overcome so much anger, injury, and risk, and even fear of arrest, to succeed in completing his mission. His rage is controlled, as evidenced by the fact he doesn't go after mother and daughter up the stairs, but once they're already dead, he keeps stabbing and slashing them, allowing himself to expel that anger and lose control, but only once Yusuko and Nina have been eliminated as threats and flight risks. Once his mission is complete, he parties by slashing them up and getting his revenge. This guy is ice cold. Most people would have exploded in rage and followed the pair to the attic. That refrain, followed by the explosive anger after death and the resulting hours spent in the house simply not giving a fuck, suggests a very cool customer. This is a hitman, and he very likely has some type of previous military training and experience. In the same stairwell, police noticed his ascent through the blood left after Mikio's murder created tracks suggesting he walked the rail side of the stairs first and then switched to the wall side without a rail farther up. That's a very basic military and law enforcement tactic used for trying to get a better view up a flight of stairs to see what's at the top. Skirting the rail or wall on either side allows maximum view of what's around the corners at the top of the stairs. It isn't much, but what it can allow you to do is see someone who thinks he's fully hidden around the corner. So you climb initially on one side against the wall and then sidestep to the other. Beyond that, since most wear and tear on stairs is caused by repetitive stepping motions in the same place at the center of the steps, leading to creaking noises derived from two pieces of material colliding, walking on the outside of the steps, where there would be very minimal wear and tear, if any, would also minimize creaking. And of course, if you wanted the victims to think you were gone, by way of either just being silent or having opened and closed the door, you'd do that. What's obvious to me here is that, on the way up, the killer would want to be able to see around the corner on the right at the top of the stairs because the ladder leading to the attic is in that direction. The victims would have to come that way. So you walk up the outside or left edge of the stairs, allowing maximum visibility to the right at the top around the corner. But once you've satisfied the notion that they aren't waiting around that corner and can't see you, you switch sides of the stairs to put yourself on the right side or their blind side before reaching the top. If you switch sides to the near wall closest to them, it forces them to extend themselves farther past the opening of the stairs to see you. Basically, they have to come forward enough to commit. And when they do, the monster is waiting. Now, it almost seems as though Nina and Yusuko froze at the top of the stairs, when you might think that the fact there were two of them would allow one to run. In truth, this positioning that the killer has is so dominant and born of complete tragic ignorance for mother and daughter that I would not be the least bit surprised to learn that they stopped cold right there upon seeing him. They reverse-engineered that universe back to the creator at the point of origin, or the intersection of the seeker and the sought, and the killer, aka creator, was waiting right there. The same thing happened to Mikio. He ran upstairs in ignorance and got killed by the dude waiting right around the corner at that mezzanine hallway intersection. So with the victims dead, the killer proceeds to ransack the house. The process doesn't appear to target any one item or all the family's valuables as though this is a robbery. However, a few things are assumed missing. Yusuko had recently received a cash payment from a student that might equate to a couple of $1,000s, and the killer tried to use Mikio's credit card online to buy theater tickets on a bookmarked page on the family's computer in the study. It's fairly obvious he wasn't looking for theater tickets, he was just testing the card to see if it worked. Other items were removed from drawers and spread throughout the home, Police found documents written in kanji laid out on tables and in other places. It's a Japanese writing system adapted from Chinese symbols. The police believed he could read these and was therefore most likely Japanese. In truth, there's no evidence he did anything more than lay them out, and here's why he did it. The presence of kanji leads police to believe he's Japanese, when everything I'm going to relate to you in relation to his identity says he's probably not Japanese at all. Along with drinking 4 bottles of barley tea from the fridge and eating 4 ice cream treats, or 4 popsicles, depending on the version of the story you hear, the killer also retrieves bandages from the first aid kit, gets towels, and when he seems to run out of items to absorb blood, he resorts to using Asuka's feminine products. He's bleeding so badly from at least one hand, his right or dominant one, we believe, that as he reads items that are laid out on the tables, or even just relaxes his hand on something, the bandages are peeling off. If you're bleeding in a way that requires stitches, bandaging the cut will just cause the bandage to soak, leak, and uproot the tape holding down the gauze. His palm is likely turned upward, and the back of the hand is laid right on top of the table as he reads, so that when he finishes and the blood that soaked through the gauze has just dried a bit over time, the bandage grabs the table on release and pulls off. The injury is likely diagonal across the hand, meaning the palm, at the base of the thumb, which is where a knife blade's trajectory would take it if it hit something hard and caused his hand to slip while stabbing, such as striking bone and breaking the knife. Now, this guy also uses the family's toilet and doesn't flush, most likely because he doesn't want to make any unnecessary noise in the middle of the night. Or he just forgot. Or he was being an asshole. It's hard to say, but what we can say for sure is that after the family is dead, this guy sticks around and makes himself at home, falling in line with the theme I mentioned earlier about them refusing to leave. It's like, okay, you refuse to leave? Fine, I'll make you leave and the place will be mine and everything in it. If only for a few hours, he acts like he lives here, helping himself to whatever he wants, from the food to beverages to the toilet to private documents and internet. So what's obvious to me is that he doesn't have anywhere to be that night. In fact, it seems like his plan was to stay here, as he actually sleeps on the couch in the second floor living room, proven by evidence. Of course, we can't prove he was sleeping, but he was lying down there. Now, the altercation with Nina and Yasuko had to be at least somewhat loud. I'm trying to imagine the killer jumping out of the shadows at the top of the stairs at 2 unsuspecting women who know he's deadly, and one of them, or even both, refrains from screaming. Not likely. This is like true-to-life House of Horrors stuff, like having Leatherface at your door. Yet, despite multiple loud confrontations with the inhabitants, he's never spooked enough to leave. And that's with Yusuko's mother living next door, too. In all honesty, I don't think he had the option of leaving after the injury, at least not in the first few hours. His clothes were soaked in blood, something we know for sure because he was forced to leave them behind. This guy left a tremendous amount of physical evidence and didn't seem to care one bit. That suggests he isn't local and doesn't fear the possibility of being detected in a database, leading me to believe he doesn't have a criminal record. He didn't have stitches to stop the bleeding on that cut, and leaving like that isn't very bright. He needed to slow the bleeding and rid his appearance of any indication, such as blood, that he just committed multiple brutal murders. So, when did he leave? My guess is that he committed the murders, ransacked the house, took a nap or rested, and then in the early morning hours, prior to dawn, when there would be nobody in the park, he slipped out the back window, down the fence, and into the night, forever unknown. Again, a person who wasn't local wouldn't have a place to go which he could call home. And if this man was staying at a hotel, it's hard to imagine he could go back there bleeding profusely. Now, having this man's clothes allows the police to learn where the items might have been purchased and when, along with the potential for revealing where they've been since. A witness reported seeing a man matching the description of our suspect in these clothes and wearing a small backpack departing a train that had just arrived on December 29th at a station only a couple of miles from the Misayawa's residence. Police obviously recovered the broken sashimi knife and subsequently learned it was purchased at an adjacent store by the train station either that day or the next. The family was murdered late on the 30th, of course, and the next day, 120 miles north of their home, at a medical center located at a train station, a man in his 30s entered with a knife wound on one hand that staff said was so deep you could see bone. They treated him, stitching the wound and sending him on his way, without asking how it occurred. DNA profiling conducted in the aftermath, though not as accurate as it might be today, narrowed the perpetrator's ancestral lineage in a way that allows us to see some interesting things. His DNA showed that, on his father's side, he has a 1 in 10 chance of being Japanese, and the same probability of being Chinese, while there's a much greater 1 in 3 chance that his father's lineage is Korean. On the other end, the maternal DNA suggests his mother is Southern European. So, we have a mixed-race perpetrator whose heritage, by way of DNA, tells us he's very likely not a native Japanese person, but fits in with the culture present there. Of course, Japan and South Korea are neighbors, and military occupation in both countries by white foreigners produced a lot of mixed-race people in previous decades. So if a mixed-race South Korean man was traveling through Japan, he would fit in just fine. Nobody would think anything of it. Of course, if you're South Korean in the year 2000, your name isn't going to pop up in a Japanese criminal database either. And if you didn't have a criminal record, then you could really not care at all, because the fingerprints would be worthless too. Familial DNA, or genealogy, wasn't in practice back then. You either had to have the criminal's DNA in a database already, or you had to nab him for something else, by chance, and proceed to get a coincidental match. If such a thing had existed back in 2000, this killer almost certainly would have been caught. But it didn't. And so, that's why this crime happened, and also what it helps produce. Better methods of detection and integrity, leading to universal truth, not only about what happened in this crime, but in human existence itself. There's too much dark irony here to ignore. 6-year-old Ray's special needs, specifically in relation to his speech impediment, were the main reason given by the family for delaying the choice to move out of their home. And then he's the first to die, and specifically, by way of being strangled to silence, in which he couldn't speak or call for help, while the rest of them were stabbed. It's almost like the killer was saying, "Don't worry, he won't have to talk anymore because he won't be able to say anything at all once he's dead." It's really awful, but again, it's the same dark comedy employed in dispatching the entire family instead of having them move out. It's like, oh, no need to worry about moving anymore, we got you. Same with the food and the drinks. The killer threw wrappers on the floor by the toilet, specifically indicating one thing we're told not to do. Shit where we eat. It's not uncommon for South Korean companies to have business interests in Japan, and my best assessment here is that the reason we have DNA, fingerprints, and no identity available is that this man is a foreigner who traveled from South Korea to Japan, at which point he took a train to a station just south of Setagaya, as expressed by the witness who saw him in the clothes he left behind. After committing the killings and leaving in the early morning just before dawn, he traveled by another train going 120 miles north away from the crime in the opposite direction, a smart move considering he'd otherwise be backtracking to places where he was already witnessed. At that train station's medical center, far away from the crime, he received attention for the wound and left without suspicion until the cops came calling to inquire about him, making the staff realize they never asked how the wound happened. From there, he's a ghost, which, to me, insinuates he got on a plane and left the country, headed back to South Korea. Of course, again, what we notice about this crime is that there's no firearm involved and that the murder weapon, a knife, is purchased near the home, suggesting that this person not only traveled, but also traveled in a manner that disallowed bringing any type of weapon. That would be air travel. A man claiming to have knowledge of the situation later came forward to express that the Misayawas were murdered as a result of a hit by a South Korean company that wanted to pay cash for their home, and Mikio refused, bringing them trouble. He named the man responsible for committing the murders, and shockingly, this person was mixed-race Korean on his dad's side and Southern European on mom's. Unfortunately, they didn't get a match to the DNA and fingerprints in the house. It wasn't him, of course, but it speaks to the truth I mentioned a moment ago. There are plenty of mixed-race people of this type, enough that such a genetic identifier would render a coincidence of that magnitude in this case. I think that when Mikio refused to sell and instead took the city's offer in the aftermath, it pissed off the people who knew the other homes would concede in the same way to follow, leaving them out of the deal as the city facilitated everything. I think losing that slice of pie made them indulge trying to get the whole thing, specifically in the form of intimidating the remaining residents to act. Ultimately, however, I think this case brought the kind of heat that nobody wants, and whatever plans they had beyond revenge for the refusal of sale in terms of making a lot of money off the scheme fell by the wayside as they were too risky. When they planned this hit, undoubtedly they didn't imagine that this stealthy killer was going to create the most outrageous DNA nightmare ever left behind. If he got in and out of this house without getting cut and bleeding everywhere, this is a totally different situation. But given the result, if you were involved in this crime in any way and it got this messy, trying to profit from it without getting caught is going to be nearly impossible. The risk goes through the roof because all it takes is for that DNA to be traced back to the killer. It's only one step removed. So, as much as his identity might keep us completely in darkness, all it would take is to identify this person through fingerprints and DNA, and the whole house of cards comes crashing down if, in fact, this was a crime commissioned by somebody else. The killer did a fabulous job of containing this crime. He showed a very strong and instinctual awareness of the locations of the entrances and exits on the structure, and baited the victims with basic yet effective psychological tactics not common to the average criminal. I see a high probability of military training in his profile. Now watch how easy this is. In Japan, conscription, or mandatory military service, betrays their constitution. Men don't have to serve. But guess which neighboring country utilizes conscription and mandates men to serve in the military? South Korea. So, if the DNA says this person most likely comes from South Korea and he's physically fit, then we can deduce without enlistment records that he almost certainly has military training. And again, these aren't extremely advanced tactics. They're just very basic maneuvers for avoiding being seen or heard by the enemy. But the cold, strategic, and psychological way they're employed speaks volumes. They sent this guy because he would handle things if shit hit the fan. He would have a plan B, like a professional. He did. He used it to absolute perfection. Things went wrong in almost any way they could, and he maintained his cool, not only getting out of the house and out of the area, but out of the country, and after not only committing 4 brutal murders, but getting medical attention for the hand he injured along the way. From the execution to the travel, this is a professional job. Sadly and disgustingly, of course, but nonetheless true. Somebody with money hired this person. When you ask what Mikio and family had going on in their lives that could be correlated to potentially large sums of money, it isn't hard to see that the prospective development of the land upon which their home sat was the bullseye on that target. Think of that stairwell, right? That intersection as just sitting in that spot, right? Where the house is. That's what it is. People, meaning a third-party company, likely tried to buy them out under the guise of ease of transition, in much the same way a company would claim to be able to repair your credit by giving you one low monthly payment while they deal directly with your creditors. If they could get Mikio to sell, especially to them, the rest would likely fall like dominoes. His mother-in-law's house next door would be next. And again, if you're the neighbor with a front door only a narrow street's width away from the Misayawa's front door and the other two families are gone, how safe will you feel there alone? Not at all. It's going to be a lot of pressure to leave. And then, with only one house left, how safe are they going to feel with this crime unsolved? The answer is that they aren't. That's what someone obviously wanted. But what they didn't bargain for was the heat brought by the physical evidence. The police know this person's height, approximate weight, build, the clothes he wore, places he went, what he ate, and more. If you were this guy, or even involved in this crime in any way, you'd have to settle for revenge on Mikio as your prize. Given that such a thing happens so rarely in Setagaya, but it's so densely populated there, the police force is large and well-equipped, and they were able to utilize a ton of resources in the effort, resulting in a well-handled investigation. But again, the point of these crimes, from an evolutionary standpoint, is to point out issues of connectivity in relation to detection and integrity. Without proper connectivity, and therefore authority, involved in investigating outside of Japan, specifically in South Korea, Japanese authorities were limited to foreign cooperation. Top that off with the truth that genealogy was yet unavailable, and you see what forms is a cocktail of ignorance derived from specific technological deficiencies. We must work together, increasingly so, and with greater regard for detection and integrity leading to truth. That which is foreign in this world is unknown. That's the theme here. When you break down this case to the smallest minutiae, what's apparent is that the killer's actions were derived from confidence related to lack of detection based in deficient methods, and those same deficient methods left him faceless. The reason that was able to happen is that he remained foreign to their abilities. This is an evolutionary masterclass, and simply one of countless cases in which law enforcement's passive approach of only acquiring the DNA and fingerprints of suspected criminals proves faulty. Many violent criminals have no prior criminal record, so if you come across one of these people and have DNA and fingerprints, sadly, unless you already know who they are, you're not able to identify them. In this case, the police collected just about every possible piece of physical evidence, which was far more than most crime scenes offer. The criminal is even like, here you go, I'll give you height, build, DNA, fingerprints, even my clothes, and you'll still fail. He's so confident of his success that he leaves that evidence all over the house. And he was right. It didn't matter. None of it. Not without connectivity. The police needed an avenue for identifying him indirectly, such as genealogy. They didn't have it. They also needed foreign cooperation. They didn't have it. Ironically, to a greater degree, we do today. But cases like this one precipitate those changes, and specifically through a lack of technological competence. That means people suffer. Not only those who were killed, but family and friends who died emotionally along the way. Is it possible this case could be solved in modern times through genealogy? Sure. Will it? That remains to be seen. But what we know for sure is that the thing that stands between us and the truth about the Setagaya murders is teamwork. As a species, we must do a better job of working together as a unit instead of apart as foreigners. That's the basis for moving from the binary universe back to the singularity from which we came. All things that are broken, all things that have been separated, will be mended. Questions with answers, hearts with minds, spirits with God. Until we reach the point of universal truth, like each of those family members peering around the corner of the stairs, until poof, just like that, it's gone. To darkness, the unknown, a place where life begins again. There's a beautiful moment in Japanese history that says a lot not only about rebirth and working together, but how we must acknowledge the symbiosis of humanity, especially in our differences, as they are part of the same life cycle. Japan is known as the land of the rising sun. However, if you're in Japan, it doesn't look as though the sun is rising from it. The land of the rising sun is a notion that came into existence between the 7th and 8th centuries when Japan was seeking sovereignty in relation to China. The Emperor of Japan sent a message requesting such to the Emperor of China, and it read, "From the Emperor of the Land of the Rising Sun to the Emperor of the Setting Sun." And when the Chinese Emperor received it, what was realized is that they are two halves of the same whole, with an invisible line between, even if night and day. If you look out at Japan from China, it appears that the sun is rising there. Thus, the land of the rising sun is from the Chinese perspective. Yet when China was referenced as the land of the setting sun, that too came from the opposite perspective, meaning the Japanese vantage point. So the land of the rising sun and land of the setting sun are not identities they formed of themselves as ego. No, these identities are formed by the other party to describe the beauty they see in each other, no matter how much their politics or shores may divide them. Therefore, all evil in a binary universe is derived from unwillingness to cooperate, or conversely, being forced to cooperate. And at the bottom of this mystery, when you ask yourself what type of lack of cooperation most likely left the Misayama family in darkness, it is, without any doubt whatsoever, the home sale. They held on for dear life as long as they could, staying put, and in a situation in which those financially interested would potentially lose far more than the family. In their ignorance, they were working against other people's interests in a way that the situation reached a tipping point. It became worthwhile to get rid of the family, despite the risk. It was advantageous to someone, and most likely for financial reasons. And again, that would likely only happen if a lot of money was at stake. And if it was, that money would be tied to a company entrenched in that type of business, likely a foreign entity based in South Korea, or at least with ties to it. My guess is that the police identified the company, yet were unable to make a connection to the killer. He's not likely someone who worked for the company, but is a person with a close relationship to someone there who vouched for him. What is also quite possible is that the killer is connected to organized crime, and Mikio Misayama, in staunch refusal to cooperate, got an offer he couldn't refuse. In the weeks leading up to the murders, a middle-aged man was seen scouting the outside of the house, while another person, or perhaps even that same man, began parking in a spot directly in front of the Misayama's house, despite having no business there as far as they could tell. It's like the person just wanted to occupy that spot, and to be in their yard. They're encroaching upon the home. It's not difficult to see this as intimidation, and it probably went further than Mikio told his family. I'm guessing Mikio was well aware of what was happening and not the least bit ignorant of the fact he was being intimidated to cooperate, but ignored them, instead choosing to move forward as planned with the city and move in March. His decision to actually finally move might have been based in that intimidation. We don't know, as his family was slaughtered along with him. Regardless, he really pissed somebody off in a big way. I think there's more to the story, and very simply from the standpoint of Mikio trying to hide the intimidation as it escalated. Clearly, it was happening. I doubt this came from out of nowhere, as it seems so personal. At the same time, the perpetrator is clearly not anybody Mikio knows personally, or that physical evidence would have long since identified the guilty party. I'll bet he was harassed on a regular basis, didn't want the deal, and finally contacted the city out of frustration to take their deal, precluding a bad situation by taking what he believed was the safe alternative. He likely hoped the harassment would stop once they knew he took the city's offer, relieving him of the burden of having to deal with them, because the point is moot once he has another deal. But ironically, it had the opposite effect, and simply because he got rid of them when they wanted to be let inside. So what did they do? They let themselves inside and kicked the family out for good. The emotional or psychological narrative at play suggests a binary setup of the company not being able to get in the house, leading to them ensuring the family left. It's pretty simple psychological math. All you have to do is identify the emotional inadequacy or the emotional wound, the hole, and the subsequent physical remedy intended to fill it. The man who commissioned this hit behaved like a fucking sociopath, but the man who committed the murders behaved like a professional hitman. For me, this one's easy. The family wouldn't sell and cut this company out entirely by taking the city's deal. If you do that, you're going to be doing it to someone who isn't used to losing, especially to the little people like you. But Mikio held on and worked his leverage. It's obvious to me that these killings are not only a lesson, but a strong message. If I can't negotiate you out of the house, I'll throw you out. And if you won't take what I'm offering, you'll get nothing, right up to and including your precious lives. Given that the random acts of indirect intimidation failed to impress, we assume Mikio didn't realize the heightened propensity for violence his actions precipitated until it was too late. More than 20 years later, however, the case still begs for justice. A truthful conclusion. Who really killed the Misayama family in the Setagaya Ward, and why? Perhaps one day we'll know. In the meantime, let's wish them eternal peace and continue to remember that the answers to our prayers lie in shadows cast along the dividing lines between us, where good meets evil and darkness joins the light.